This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Garden Show with Charlie Dobbin, heard every Saturday morning at 9 on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. Welcome, friend, to our weekly garden party. We hope you brought along your questions because it's time to dish the dirt. On The Garden Show with Charlie Dobbin, exclusively on Zoomer Radio.
Yes, good morning and welcome to The Garden Show with Charlie Dobbin on Zoomer Radio, aided and abetted by yours truly, Dean Holland. How are you, Charlie?
Oh my goodness, welcome to spring. It's... Okay, it's not snowing at my house, but is it snowing at your place?
Oh, it is. I woke up this morning and I looked out the window and I thought, what is that? And again, I hadn't thrown my glasses on right away, which I need for distance. And I thought, is that like fog? And then I thought, no, maybe it's a fine rain. And then I looked, I thought, oh my goodness, we're sitting right on the border. Like we're at 2 degrees here in Collingwood right now. Okay. So we've got this mix. Because it's colder up top. And, of course, up the escarpment, which is very close to us, just at, you know, where Blue Mountain is, of course, just a few minutes away, is always at about a degree and a half cooler. Right. So it's cooler up there. So we're getting a bit of slushy, snowy, rainy flurries right now. And it's all white on the ground.
Yeah. Wow. Well, okay, so here it's well above zero. We're 5 or 6 degrees in Prince Edward County with rain in the forecast. It is a very overcast day. So when you look out, it's kind of gray and nothing's growing really obviously yet. But if you go outside, cover your eyes and just open your ears, it's spring. The birds are going crazy. Yeah. They're all chitter-chattering to each other and flipping and flopping and gathering nest-building materials. It's very cool.
Yeah, and we have heard that here as well, but I don't know if I'd hear it as much this morning if I went out the door. No. But you know what? Those crocuses are still coming up. They're going, nope, I'm here.
Yeah, exactly. And I have snowdrops up as well.
Beautiful.
Well, you know,
you've got snowdrops. You've got snowdrops, and I've got snow flurries.
So there you go. We got the snow covered. It is still March.
Yes.
Soon it will be. Actually, it's your birthday really soon, isn't it? Yeah, next week.
Next week, Thursday. Yeah.
Thursday.
And World Theater Day.
Oh, even better. Is it always your birthday on World Theater?
Yeah, March 27th is since 1961. So before I was born, it was World Theater Day on that day. Yeah. And I didn't realize it probably till I was in my 20s when it actually meant something, when I was all of a sudden a thespian and I thought, hey, that's cool.
Given
what I've done for a living my whole life, it's
I know you're such
fun.
A performer. Well, so that's so interesting. I always wonder, is it because you learn about something and then you become it, or you're already it and then it becomes you kind of thing? Like where, like for example, when I read Aries horoscopes, because I'm an Aries, I go, this is me. Like somebody knows me and wrote this, right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, so why is that so perfectly matched? Is it because I read that when I was a child, or did they meet me and write that? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. You and I've talked about how when you were younger, that you loved to play in the dirt and you loved to dig in the dirt and you loved stuff, you know, and so this was a very natural road for you.
True.
You know what? All I can say is that when I got up on stage, when I was in grade 10, it was like a complete epiphany. And it was like, I felt right then and there during that production that this is where I needed to be. And I told my mother in grade 10, that's what I need to do for the rest of my life.
I'm doing this. Good for you. Do you want to do the numbers? And then I want to give an update on the great backyard bird count. The final results are in.
You got it. And I'm going to do these numbers in a very theatrical way. How's that? How's that? Okay.
Sweet.
If you are living in Toronto, please give us a call at 416-360-0740 or anywhere in the province of Ontario outside Toronto, 1-866-744-740. Do let Owen know if you are a first-time caller. And I'll give you those. Yes, our dramatic garden wings. And please call often, call early, and one question per call, please. We would really, really appreciate that. Okay, so we can get everybody in. Yeah, and so an update on the big backyard bird count, which happened, was it 3 weekends ago now?
Maybe I'm more. It was a number, 1, 2, 3.
Was it early March? First weekend of March, I think.
It's February, usually.
Anyway. Well, February, oh yeah. So maybe it's longer.
Was February, middle of February, 14th. Wow. So, yeah, wow. I know.
Almost a month ago.
And to you, it's like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
You're a busy guy. But here's what the world accomplished with the great backyard bird count. Over 8,000 species of birds were identified. So 8,078. 217 countries participated in the eBird count. 387,000 checklists came in. Merlin, so if you've got a smartphone, you must download the app, the Merlin app. It's a bird ID app. And it's so cool because, I mean, I'm such a neophyte at birds, so that when I hear, like I said to you, if I step out and I can just hear these birds chitter-chattering, I'm like, I don't even know who they are. I can't see them. I flip on my little Merlin app and I say, listen to these birds. And it listens, my phone listens, and then it identifies what it's hearing. It tells me, that's a red-winged blackbird.
It is a great app.
That's an American, robin. Like it just starts listing everything it's hearing. It's amazing. So anybody who hasn't got that app and likes birds, do get it, because over 600,000 people use the Merlin app as part of the bird count. Anyway, roughly 838,000 estimated global participants, which is very cool. So across the world, people participated for the 4-day bird count.
It's and I do believe that year. You and I are part of that list.
Yes, so is Elliot. Elliot was so all Elliot over as
well.
It.
Yeah. Well, I think it is one of the slickest, one of the neatest, what do we call it? It's like community science experiments, you know, a global experiment.
Yeah,
I think it's how many experiments like that do you get to weigh in on that people from around the world get to? There can't be that many on the same weekend.
No, you're right. Like from an international perspective, it is very unusual. There are often citizen science projects, but they tend to be more local.
Yeah.
Here in Canada, we have a citizen science project, which is all about the hardiness zones, the plant hardiness zones. Mm-hmm. So because there's so many microclimates across this huge country that, you know, you can't lay a line down and say, that's zone 5 and that's zone 6. So instead, a lot of this zone identification is based on actual participants who live there in those areas, identifying what zone they're living in based on the plants they can grow and the kind of snow they get, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, whatever zone that you are living in, give us a call. And again, the numbers are, if you live in Toronto, in those zones, 416-360-0740, or anywhere else within the province of Ontario, here's a toll-free number, 1-866-740-4740. We would like to talk about whatever zone you're in and whatever question you have. You have one more thing before we go, Charlie?
I was just going to say quickly, I neglected to remind everybody that the Haldimand Hort Society, big garden show on April the 5th from 9 until 2 at the Riverside Exhibition Center, 151 Caithness Street East in Caledonia. Very fun day, very big day. And our friend Paul Oliver will be at that show because he is presenting about wild birds and how to attract wild birds on that day, April the 5th. Speaking of Paul Oliver, he was supposed to join us last Saturday. He was very ill. He wasn't able to, but he will be joining us next Saturday.
Beautiful. Okay. Well, we will be right back with much more on this first spring garden show of 2025. Okay? Right back here on Zoomer Radio.
Daffodils and daisies, bluebells and begonias, forsythia and foxgloves, marigolds, magnolia, lavender and lupins, dahlias, delphiniums, stocks, phlox, hollyhocks, tulips and sweet williams.
You've picked the right place for everything floral. This is The Garden Show with Charlie Dobbin, exclusively on Zoomer Radio.
Oh, yes, we are back here on The Garden Show, and I think it is a telltale sign of the fact that it is spring. Of course, spring arrived on Thursday, the 20th, at about 5 a.m. This is the second full day of spring, first garden show of spring 2025, and the lines are just lighting up. And so let's get to our first caller. We have Barbie on the line from Burlington. Welcome to the Garden Show, Barbie.
Thank you, and good morning to both you and Charlie.
Good morning.
I have a question regarding lotus seeds versus bowl lotuses. Are they treated the same? I can't find any detailed information on once they sprout what to do with them. They just show them all of a sudden they're in bloom.
Of course.
And we got sucked in by the lovely color and all this, and now I've got these seeds, and I started sprouting some, but I don't know which ones I've got and how to care for them. It's like, oh, my goodness, what do I do? And I try and see videos of them, but I don't seem to find the bowl lotus ones and help.
Okay, so I would love to help, but what are you saying, vole, like V-O-L-E, lotus? No, what's the other
bowl,
lotus?
Bowl, in cereal bowl, lotus.
Oh, bowl lotus. Oh, bowl lotus.
And it shows them like in an indoor setting, whereas the others seem to be outside and make your neighbors envious of
this. Okay, so I would say, just not knowing for positive sure, but I would say a bowl, so we know lotuses grow in water. So we typically will, if we're growing lotus, we have some kind of a pond or a bowl to place our lotus plants in. And like you said, make our neighbors all envious. I would assume that bowl lotuses tend to be more of a dwarf plant, if I was going to say what's the difference. I think the way you would grow them is exactly the same. And there is quite a bit, actually. I have never grown lotus, particularly from seed, but they don't flower for the first 2 years, I can tell you that much. And they need lots of sun and lots of water changes.
Yes. I started some seeds and they've all sprouted, but I didn't do, I think I did three or four of them, and they all sprouted because I wasn't sure if they would sprout at all. And then I was trying to find information, and one said, don't put them in the sun. Don't let the water, you know, as they're sprouting, don't let them in direct sun. And I'm thinking, oh, they've been sitting on the kitchen table by the, not necessarily by the window, but the sun shines in there. And it's like,
what I'm looking at here, once they're sprouted, you know, once you've got germination of those seeds and you've got roots on those little seedlings, move them to a larger container with water and mud in the bottom of the container. It needs to be a large, deep pot, obviously no holes in the bottom, and ensure the plants receive at least 6 hours of sunlight per day. But keep that water clean, change it regularly, and remember to fertilize, a balanced fertilizer specifically designed for aquatic plants. And you are in Burlington, so you go to your local Terra greenhouses. They've got a great water plant department.
Okay.
And you can get your fertilizer there.
Far from there. Yeah.
Yeah, I would think.
Well, I just figured I would start in spring and find out.
Yeah, I want to know more. I've never grown lotus seeds or lotus at all. So you need to call us. As soon as you see a flower, you call. That'll be in a couple of years, I think, though.
I'll let you know. I'll keep you apprised. How's that?
Please do. Thank you. Thanks for calling.
Thanks very much, Barbie.
Okay, thank you.
Have a great day. Charlie, Barbie has reminded me of lilies. I love traveling, you know, in the Halliburton's, Corthas, and that. And you go there and you see the pond full of lilies.
Yeah.
I always find them so magical. I just love them.
Well, and part of the magic is that they close when the sun goes behind a cloud. Like, don't you love it when plants respond? And obviously, as the day gets darker, or if you try and cut them and take them home, they close up right in your hand. It's like quite a challenge, but they're beautiful and fragrant.
Are they, I sort of interpret them as being very much like, I could be wrong, almost like a trillium, where you're better to leave them where they are and enjoy them rather than to try and bring them home and try and grow them in your pond.
They're not hard to grow in a pond, but you do need certain requirements in that pond. One thing is they want still water. So when you see them in nature, they're always up against the shore. They're all tucked into the little nooks and crannies where it's nice and still. But when we used to go to Tomogamy, Lake Tomogamy all the time. We always would go out in the canoe when we were kids and gather armloads of lilies to bring home to my mom. And of course they would sit in the bottom of the canoe and just close right up. But as soon as you got them back and you gave them water and you put them in the sun, they'd all open. It was beautiful.
Wow, beautiful indeed. Okay, give us a call, 416-360-0740 or 1-866-740-4740. We'll be right back with much more on The Garden Show.
Don't change stations just because the weather changes. Garden tips and advice all year round. This is The Garden Show with Charlie Dobbin, exclusively on Zoomer Radio.
Yes, indeed. We are back here on The Garden Show on this 22nd of March. And it is spring. And we are going to go to our next caller. We have Jean on the line from Newmarket. Welcome to The Garden Show, Jean.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. And please, Charlie, what plants are good for mosquitoes? But I want perennials. I'm not that kind of a gardener that'll plant them every year.
All right. So here's some suggestions. I mean, the first one we most of us know is called citronella, usually pretty available in the organic area, or it's not a native plant, but if it's available in garden centers, it's really a form of
Charlie,
perennial.
I'm going to interrupt you. I can't hear you. It's all garbled like you're underwater. So I'll phone back. Okay.
Okay. Or just hang up. Yeah, that's a funny, something's going on with Jean's line there. Hopefully Jean hangs up and then puts up her radio. Citronella, a form of geranium. It is with any of the plants that we grow to repel insects like mosquitoes, they only really work if you rub them, right? So any of the smelly, rubbable plants, oregano, basil, rosemary, thyme, any of those things, if you go out and rub them, you will send off an aroma, which most mosquitoes will avoid. And citronella is the classic. It smells like lemon. It smells like lemon pledge, the old furniture polish we don't use anymore. But and these are perennials. I mean, basil is not, of course. Catnip is a great one. It's a beautiful plant. Blue flowers or white flowers, depending. But from mint, if you're prepared to grow something like mint, because it can be a very invasive plant. But it's just a matter of growing something that's highly aromatic, and don't be afraid to rub it to get some action.
Okay, and that was my question. Is it not enough to just keep the basil, or the citronella, is it not enough to just keep it around your patio? You actually have to sort of activate it by rubbing it. Okay.
Really? Yeah, in my experience, unless somebody else out there has had a different experience. And the other thing, remember, with mosquitoes is they are very weak flyers. So if you are troubled by mosquitoes and you're on a porch, say, for example, where there's no wind, just set up a fan, a really slow-moving fan. It's like a tiny bit of air movement and the mosquitoes can't get you because they can't fight the wind or get out into the wind. And same thing, mosquitoes can't land.
Okay, excellent. Well, let's go to our next caller. We have Kathy on the line from Markham. Welcome to The Garden Show, Kathy.
Good morning to both of you.
Morning.
My question is, how good is the sheep manure mixed with the black earth for the garden?
This is for your garden?
Yes.
It's excellent.
Because I used to buy all of these. Either cow manure, just cow manure and sheep manure, not mixed with anything.
It depends on the quality of your existing soil. Straight composted manure is fine to add to existing soil. You'll never go wrong adding manure. But if you're, it can be expensive to just put, 6 inches of manure onto your soil. So if you're, depending on the amount of supplementing you're looking at adding, which we all should be doing every year, all of our gardens, even our lawns, need to be amended and supplemented because the organic material breaks down and disappears. So your gardens are always, the level drops. If you've got lots of organic material, it disappears and drops. So we're always adding, we're always buffing, pumping it all back up. So minimum half an inch a year, but and you can go straight manure, or you can do a mix with something like black earth and manure. It's just really, like I said, depends on the quality of your existing soil.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much, Kathy.
And, remember as well, you can always do a soil test if you're not sure. There's lots of great little soil test kits available in garden centers at this time of year. And there's the option to send soil to get a really deep test done at one of the Ontario Ministry of Ag and Food test labs.
Right. Now, Kathy has reminded me about my intention. It was my intention last year and it didn't happen. But we've talked about it before in the air, how, you know, for so many years, I've been out of the practice of composting because the green bin program came along.
Yes.
Yeah, it really did. And, you know, and we had, you know, four kids. And so life was busy. And so everything went into the green bin. But I'm at the point now where I go, you know what? I think I'm going to start separating it. I'm going to start using some of the non-meat things, you know, and non-dairy things on my own garden.
Sure.
Do you have a favorite type of composter? And how much sun a day does that need to do its job properly? Because, you know, I think the tendency is to stick it in a far corner somewhere. But if it's too shady and out of the way, it's not going to do its job, right?
It will. But the thing is, in the sun, it'll go faster. Because of the heat. So that's why composters are always black, right? They're black to absorb the heat from the sun, the radiant heat, heating up what's inside, which speeds up the decomposition. But it also dries out what you're composting is you have to water. You have to add water.
Right.
If you're in the shade, it's not going to go as fast. You're not going to need to add as much water, right? Because, you don't have that heat buildup. You know what? Composters are – it's been so long since I bought one. It just kind of depends where you're going with it.
Right, because I've seen the ones that you turn as well.
Amazing. They're the best by far, but they also cost a lot of money. Because what's cool about those is as you turn the drum, the composter drum, you are doing the mixing that speeds up the decomposition. Whereas when it's sitting on the ground in a big, you know, round or square box, it's much harder to do that kind of a great mix. But, you know, compost happens. Like we say, it happens whether you like it or not. If you just got to remember those, you know, the greens, the browns, and some water. That's the main thing.
Okie dokie. Okay. We have a few first-time callers on the line. We're going to go to the first of three I'm seeing four, actually. And we've got Andy on the line, and he is calling from Toronto. Welcome to the Garden Show, Andy.
Yes, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. I want to give you your garden wings, sir. There you go. There you go.
Welcome,
thank you very much.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
And what do you got for Charlie there, Andy?
Charlie?
Yes.
What is a Charlie?
What have you got for Charlie? What's the question you have for Charlie?
Oh, what do I have for Charlie? Sorry. I'd like to know what the prognosis is for domestic songbirds vis-a-vis avian flu. And if we happen to come across a carcass in our yards, is there someone that we should be submitting it to for lab analysis?
Okay, good question. You know what? From what I know, avian flu is obviously a much bigger deal where we've got masses of birds together because it's very, very contagious. So the commercial production of eggs, et cetera, on different duck and goose and chicken farms is where we're tending to have the outbreaks. For the home person who's not raising birds but is enjoying wild birds, I think that there's always the possibility that you will find a carcass that's for no apparent reason has died. And at that point, yes, very carefully bagging and sealing the bag can be a consideration. And I'm just going to double check who you call. It might be more a case of just a web. Let them know that you have found the following bird. They will test if it's a new area, and then I'll tell you who they are. I'll just have to double check exactly what it's called. And you know, next week, Andy, listen to the Garden Show next Saturday, because we will have Paul Oliver on the show, and he is an expert in wild birds and urban nature. So he will be a very good person to give us a good analysis on the chances of avian flu. And if you have any suspicions that a bird has died of avian flu, on next best steps. But give me a minute before this show is over. I will announce who you contact in the case of a bird being found on your property. Okay.
Okay. One additional consideration. You mentioned species that tend to flock, and I think immediately of pigeons and starlings and sparrows, and but especially the starlings. So we have those in our area, and crows are pretty gregarious. And right. I'm wondering if that is a vulnerable group.
Probably. I'm just double checking here. So the Canadian, okay, here we are. CFIA, which stands for, well, I'll tell you in a second. Oh, Canadian inspection. Canadian Food Inspection Agency is, of course, okay. leading the response to avian flu. And, of course, there's the biosecurity and reporting requirements. So if you suspect your birds have avian influenza, you must report it to the CFIA. If you find a sick or dead wild bird, contact the Canadian Wildlife Health Cooperative. So Canadian Wildlife Health Cooperative, if you find a sick or dead wild bird.
Okay, that's perfect. That's exactly what I needed. Thank you so much.
Good stuff.
Thanks
Thank
very much
you.
For the call, Andy. And great that we're having Paul on the show next week.
Yeah.
Part of the conversation.
Well, exactly. And if just for anybody who just listened to that and is concerned, the Canadian Wildlife Health Cooperative can be reached at 1-800-567-2033 or through their online reporting tool.
Okay, and if you don't have a pen or a pencil, we'll try and remember to give that number one more time at the end of the show so you have time to get your pen and paper. Okay, let's go to our next caller. We have another first-time caller on the line, as I indicated. We have Joyce. Joyce is calling from Toronto. Welcome to the Garden Show, Joyce.
Hi, thank you very much, and thank you for taking my call.
Joyce, I'm going to give you your garden weeds before you...
I have Joyce? A laced-up elderberry. It's a space saver, so it grows vertically, and it's got to the point, it's sort of gone in my neighbor's tree. I'd like to prune it. When is the best time? It's really vigorous. It's a very healthy plant, but I don't want to kill it by pruning.
Okay.
Okay. Dean's jumping in. Dean is going to give you the garden wings. Joyce, you just jumped all over me, and I couldn't give you your garden wings. And so I want to do that.
You're a first time caller. You get wings.
There you go. Ooh. Those are for you, Joyce.
Welcome. Welcome to the show. So,
Thank
Joyce,
you.
is it black lace elder you've got?
Yes. And because I keep all the things that come with it, it says laced up space saver elderberry, but I think it's a black lace.
Yeah. Well, it's from the black lace family, which is a lovely plant. So purple leaves. Some people use it as a Japanese maple replacement because much hardier than a Japanese maple. So it handles our cold, extreme cold winters. A very, very vigorous plant. Don't worry about killing it. You won't be able to.
Oh, that's good.
Sorry for laughing, but it is, it's very, yes. So if it's tall and narrow, but it's, 12 feet tall and that's just silly, you don't want it so big, cut it down by half. And do it anytime. What I would probably do is I would keep an eye on it for the next few weeks. At some point, you're going to start to see little purple buds. And what you want is you want growth from the bottom. You don't want all that growth way up at the top with a bunch of naked stems and branches with all the purple leaves way at the tips. So instead, cut it down to encourage some growth from the bottom. So you'll have a nice bushy purple column growing up into that spot where you've planted it.
Is there any specific place that I should prune?
Well, on all of our deciduous plants, there are bumps on the branches, little bumps that are just, it's a smooth bark, and then there'll be a little bump. So each of those bumps are called a node, and at that bump, hidden from view, is a bud that is dormant. It is fast asleep, waiting for you to do the right thing to make it grow. And what you can do to make that dormant bud grow into a leaf and a branch eventually is you cut above the bumps. So you've got your nice clean tools, slightly angled cut. And of course, look at the bumps and make sure that those nodes or bumps are growing to the outside and not to the inside so that the next growth will give you a nice form.
Oh, okay. I wouldn't have thought of that. Great. Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks very much, Joyce. As Charlie says, don't be a stranger. Make sure you call us back.
Coffee's always on.
Yeah. Now, I have a question for you, Charlie, based on Joyce's question, and that is there a fine line between hearty and invasive.
Do they go hand in hand?
Why? Because I saw you. I saw the look on your face, and I thought, okay, I'm just wondering where that shifts. You know.
Well, you know what? One person's invasive is another person's vigorous, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Like sometimes we have a shrub isn't a good example, but sometimes we have areas in our garden where nothing grows. Like think of some of the homes and subdivisions that are so close together that yep. there's gravel in between. You can barely yes. get a wheelbarrow down there. So you might just leave the gravel and walk away. But then you might say, oh, but I could grow something in there, something that's very invasive that will just yeah. grow like gout weed. But yeah. you've got to make sure you don't let it take off and get out into the neighborhood. The black lace series of elders, very, very pretty when they first introduced them, of course, because it was a selection that was, I think, proven winners brought that out first about 20 years ago. And yeah, they get flowers, pink flowers and lovely purple leaves. And a lot of people love that. And it's for good reason. You don't want all green leaves in your garden. You want yeah. some you know, different textures, different colors. And we don't just rely on flowers for color.
Okay, we're going to go to another first-time caller. We have Nancy on the line. Nancy, welcome to the Garden Show. You are a first-time caller.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, morning. So I'm going to give you your garden wings, okay, before I hand you over to Charlie. Okay. There you go, my dear.
Thank you.
Okay, and what do you got?
I have a PJM rhododendron in my backyard. It's mm-hmm. been there for about 20 years, mm-hmm. and it faces southeast sun. And mm-hmm. For the past 3 years, there's been branch die-off. Each year, a huge branch has died off, and it's doing the same thing this year, whereas there's a rhododendron beside it on one side, and there's a pious on the other side, and pyrus, and they're doing fine.
Okay, so a major branch dying off. How big is the PJM now, roughly?
It's about four feet.
Yeah, tall and wide?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, so could it be that the weight of snow in the winter landing on the rhododendron is an evergreen, so it's got big leaves. Could there be some damage caused by the snow causing some cracking in some of these bigger branches? Like in the bark? No.
Except for this year, which was there was a lot of snow. We really maintain and make sure we clear off everything carefully. And mm-hmm. and it's been a beautiful, beautiful
yeah.
place.
No kidding.
3 years, and everything else around it is fine, which is bizarre.
Well, not really. Something's going on there. Okay, there is root weevils, but then if everything else is fine, I'm just quickly
looking. And I did
looking.
Send a picture through the website, but I'm not sure.
Oh, did you? To me? Okay, yeah, no, I will look at it, Nancy. Thank you. I mean, so PJM, one of my all-time favorite rhododendrons, because it's so hardy and it's so... It adds so much beauty in the spring, and it's such a low maintenance plant. Generally, we don't have to prune, we don't have to spray, we don't have to do anything. I do fertilize my rhododendrons, and I do add soil acidifier in the spring. But then if you've got happy rhodo, happy pieris, and then unhappy rhodo, then something might be going on specifically on that one. I don't think of them as short-lived plants. Sometimes, you know, plants only have so many years and then they start to go down. Root rot can't be the problem if everybody else is fine, unless it's a really poorly drained area. You are watering too much shade. Nope, not a problem. Fertilizer burn. Nope. Right. Okay. Southeast should be a good location. I mean, we don't want really full sun on rhodos ever. So eastern is always great. I tend to go more northeastern if I can, just to avoid the hot beating down sun. Yellow leaves? No, just sudden dieback.
Yep.
Tell you what, Charlie, I have to run to a break, but Nancy, thanks very much for the call. And Nancy, if and for others, if you have a moment and you can send a photo to Charlie as well. Her email is c.Dobbin@mzmedia.com. We will be right back with much more on The Garden Show.
Fur and feathers and bugs of all size. There's more going on in the garden than you realize. Should small creatures become a big problem, then you've got The Garden Show with Charlie Dobbin. Exclusively on Zoomer Radio.
Yes, indeed, we are back here on Zoomer Radio on The Garden Show, the first installment of The Garden Show of spring of 2025. And let's go to our next caller. We have Jay on the line from Bolton. Welcome to The Garden Show, Jay.
Hey, thank you.
Morning.
Good morning.
What do you got for us?
So I have a question about my lilac bushes. So I have two of them at the sides of the house. They're 10 feet high. They're kind of grown out of control, and I want to cut them to about half the size. So somebody was telling me that I should cut them between 2 and 4 feet high, and they said that even if I cut below the current buds that are there now, that maybe in a couple of years, new buds will form, even though I've cut below the current buds. And I'm also wondering what time of the year should I cut these? Should I do it now, or should I wait till the fall?
Okay, good questions, and timely as well. So we know lilacs bloom in what would be considered late spring or mid-spring. If you prune them now, you'll be pruning away this year, some of this year's flowers. Sometimes we make that choice because we feel the need to prune something regardless of losing some of its beauty, because of course next year is another year and there'll be more flowers next year. My question to you is, there are different kinds of lilacs. Can you tell me what color these lilacs are?
So they were always purple, but somehow in the past like 5-6 years, one of the sides of the house, like a white one, has sprouted up as well too. So that side has like white and purple.
Oh, sweet. So like a dark purple, obviously, not a traditional lilac purple.
I don't know the difference between like traditional or dark. To me, it's it looks kind of dark, I guess you could say.
Well, yeah. So the reason I'm asking is because there's a very, like the native, what would be called Syringa, native sativa is a very tough plant. And you can just do almost anything to that plant and it'll keep growing back. And it actually will do a takeover and become a forest if you let it. Some of the old farmhouses and farmsteads were across Ontario. The buildings are long gone, but the stands of lilacs are huge and still there. Then there's another kind of lilac, which is a French lilac, and it's been grafted. It's not a sort of a pale purple. They tend to be bicolors and pinks and whites and dark purples and all these different sort of double flowers. Lots of really cool different looks to lilacs, but they are considered French lilacs. They are not native to Canada, to North America. So the bottom line for you, what I would suggest you do, you get out some very sharp saw or loppers, you get down on your hands and knees, you go out and you crawl underneath those big tall lilacs, and you should take out the older stems, no more than 1/3. So say, is it a single stemmed tree with lots of branches, or is it a bunch of stems growing from the ground?
Two things I'll say. So it's a bunch of stems growing from the ground, but the type of lilac that it is, it's same as when you're driving the country roads and you see all those old houses with the, like you said. So it's the same kind as like everywhere else.
Yeah. So perfect. Yeah. So you've got, like you said, lots of branches growing from ground level. So what you're going to do is with sharp loppers or a saw, if necessary, you are going to actually cut at ground level out some of the bigger as in wider, older stems, and at ground level. So if you're looking at these and you count at the base that there's 10 stems growing up from the ground, then you're going to take out 3 of them this spring, anytime you want. You can do it on a non-rainy day this week, or you could wait until after they flower and then, you know, enjoy the flowers and then cut it all out then. I would not do this in the fall. This is a spring job. And by taking out the older branches, you're going to lower the height of the plant, because right now your older branches are your 10 footers. Your younger ones are, you know, 5 and 6 feet. So getting out some of those big tall ones, suddenly the plant starts to lower. Next year, you're going to do the same thing again. You're going to take out 1/3 of the older branches. So it's going to take you 3 years, but you will have all new growth coming from the ground in 3 years if you, over the next 3 years, take out the older stuff 1/3 at a time.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Make sense?
Perfect. Yep.
Sweet.
Okay.
Thanks
for the call there, Jay. Yeah, yeah. Okay. We're going to run to our last break. We'll be right back with much more on The Garden Show.
Daffodils and daisies, bluebells and begonias, forsythia and foxgloves, marigolds, magnolia, lavender and lupins, dahlias, delphiniums, stalks, fox, hollyhocks, tulips and sweet williams.
You've picked the right place for everything floral. This is The Garden Show with Charlie Dobbin, exclusively on Zoomer Radio.
We are back here on The Garden Show, and because we've got a couple of callers on the line and we only have about 8 minutes left, we're going to go right to our next caller, Ken, who is another first-time caller from Scarborough. Welcome to The Garden Show, Ken.
Thank you, and good morning.
Morning.
Here are your garden wings, my friend.
Okay. My question is regarding lawns. I've noticed in our neighborhood, and especially on my own lawn, over the last couple of days, the telltale signs of skunks looking for grubs.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems awfully early in the season for the grubs to be coming up and feeding.
It does.
Yeah.
It maybe it's just because you're in sunny Scarborough.
Well, best place in the world to live. Anyway,
it does seem very early. I'm wondering, grubs, normally, raccoons, skunks, starlings, these are all creatures that love grubs. They are like a jumbo shrimp to them. Mm-hmm. They are just like the best little sauce. And down they go. So we kind of encourage, in a sense, the animals to eat the grubs because the grubs are eating our lawns. And so, of course, the animals are making a mess of the lawn, but then again, the grubs are actually killing the lawn. So, it's always that cost-benefit analysis. It seems a bit early to me that this is happening in Scarborough in March because it was a long winter. You would have had frozen ground and snow. And of course, where do the grubs go all winter? They go below the frost line. They go down in the fall. They stay dormant and alive down, 3-4 feet below surface, and then come crawling back up to start chewing on the roots of your lawn. I can only think maybe there's some warm patches, sunny spots that have just thawed sooner than some of the shadier areas in your yard and some of your neighbors' yards where the grubs have come up. Did you see any damage last fall at all?
For sure. Last year was the real fight against them. I tried Grubbegun and nematodes, and it was just an ongoing fight from the end of the summer on.
Yeah, they grubs are, of course, the immature June beetles or any of those beetles that fly around and drive us crazy, Japanese beetles. Mm. So those are the adults. Of course, they lay eggs and then the eggs hatch and we get the grubs. So it's a circle. It's a the life cycle is such that at this time of year, those shrimp-like, large, fat, juicy grubs will become those beetles that are going to emerge and start flying around, usually in May and June, to lay more eggs. So the best time to try and kill and control is in the fall when the eggs have just hatched, the grubs are young, they're at the surface, they're very, very susceptible to things like nematodes and grub be gone. But you've got to be really, really specific to follow all the instructions exactly.
Right.
There's never 100% kill on them, but what you're trying to do is kill enough that they're not going to damage or cause, huge damage to your lawn.
Yeah.
For now, raking out the dead stuff. Don't try and fix your lawn until the adults have emerged. It's going to be another month or more. And then fix your lawn as best as you can. Top dress, overseed, fertilize, do all the right things. The thicker and healthier your lawn, the fewer eggs that get laid into it.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks very much for the call there, Ken. I got to run to our last caller. We have Monica on the line from Oakville. Welcome to The Garden Show, Monica.
Thank you very much, Steve. Good morning, Charlie.
Morning.
What do you got there?
I just very quickly wanted to caution all of us keen gardeners who are dying to get out there and clean up the garden to please, please, please keep in mind that our native bees are nesting in our dead plant stems. Mm-hmm. And early cleanup can destroy 6 months of bee development if we get at it too early. Mm-hmm. I understand that you're supposed to wait until May to clean up before you've had some 50 degree Fahrenheit consistent temperatures. Is that true, Charlie?
It is, and you're absolutely right. The hollow stems of many of our perennial plants and our ornamental grasses that we're desperate to clean up because they don't look very pretty at this time of year are the home of many little creatures, as well as many of the leaves that we might have placed over the top of our gardens in the fall. Adding good organic matter has also added that nice home, if you will, for lots of different creatures. You can go in with gloves. You can move the leaves around. You'd be amazed what you'll find sometimes when you move the leaves around, just to move them off where the hostas are going to come up or where certain plants are going to come up. Don't do a lot of cutting back, but certainly rifling the leaves around will speed up their decomposition. And this is a great time of year. Rake your lawn. Your lawn will appreciate any good care you can do for it at this time of year. I have a lot of flattened lawn from the snow we had, and I know a lot of Ontario is the same, where the lawn just, and I bet you Dean still got snow on his lawn.
Yeah.
Once your snow is gone, Dean, you're going to get out your fan rake, and you're going to do that raking. It's a pretty vigorous, it's very good for getting us ready for spring. It gets our, adrenaline going, but it also gets, the abdominal muscles and the shoulders in shape for what's coming. And just doing that really, really stiff raking with the fan rake, get the dead stuff out, get the little blades standing back up. And yes, exactly. Try and stay off the gardens and stay away from cutting things back too early.
Well, thank you for confirming that. I know one of your morning hosts there said she was going to go out and do a thorough cleanup this weekend, and I thought, oh no, please don't do that. But I must say, since talking to Rick Gray on your show and buying his book, I have been replacing a lot of my lawn with native plants. So the lawn is shrinking and the garden is growing, and I'm very happy about that.
Oh yeah. Oh, absolutely. Great. It's, it's one or the other, right? And sometimes we just have a large property. We've got to have some lawn, but yeah, the bigger the gardens, the more you support the wildlife and pollinators, because that's part of our job, is to help the pollinators.
Great. Thank you very much for the call there, Monica. And hey, here we are, the end of our first spring show.
And
we have about 90 seconds left.
Things are hopping big time.
Yeah, I want to mention again, remember we said we'd give out that number again for anybody who has the bird stuff, if you have that handy.
Yeah, I do.
And I'll also give out your email again. If you have things, we had that caller earlier, you would have the name there. I'm sorry, the woman who called.
It was Nancy.
Nancy, about the about her rhododendron.
Right.
If you have a picture, and I think she did send you some pictures, actually. Yes. c.dobbin@mzmedia.com. Sometimes things like that are very difficult to describe.
Yeah.
And a picture can be a help, so you can send Charlie an email.
For sure. And if you do find a sick wild bird or a dead wild bird, you can phone 1-800-567-2033 to report that bird, because of course we are trying to stay right on top of avian flu and any spreading of the flu. excuse me, Monica brought up a good point, getting into the garden too early, try and avoid it. So I mentioned lawns, but the other thing is, it's a great time to start seeds. Get your fingers dirty, planting some. I've got my peppers planted. I've planted parsley. I've planted assorted annual flowers. I got my sweet potatoes started to get my slips growing. So yeah, get that need for horticulture out, maybe under some grow lights somewhere else on your property.
I love it.
It's okay. Fun. Thanks, Dean.
Yeah, I think it's time for us to say goodbye.
It is. It is. So you have a great week. I know you're a busy guy filling in for all kinds of people. We now call this the Dean Holland Station. I know. Some people think it's, Zoomer Radio, but it's not really. It's Dean Holland Zoomer Radio.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks, Owen. And welcome, Joe. We've got Joe in training. So thanks to both you guys. Couldn't do any of this without your help. And obviously, thanks to all the great callers. See you again next week.
This has been an exclusive podcast of The Garden Show with Charlie Dobbin. Heard every Saturday morning at 9 on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.